On the frontier, you get a chance to try things out. And Alaska's been a frontier for journalism for ages. It's everything from storytelling to reality TV. We have the resources, and my guest is here to tell you. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Return with us now to the thrilling days of the ad hoc legislature in the empire of Jess Carr. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call, 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Howard Weaver is live in the studio today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, here we are. The book is Right Hard, Die Free, Dispatches from the from the Battlefields and Barrooms of the Great Alaska Newspaper War. He means every bit of it. Howard Weaver was a managing editor of the Anchorage Daily News, grew up in Alaska, grew up in Muldoon, and kind of got to have the job of his dreams and watch a whole lot of stuff happen. And eventually left the state, lives in California now. But Howard, what did you retire from McClatchy, or how come you're not with McClatchy anymore?
Well, I did retire. It was a sort of early retirement. I was 58 when I left the company. That's been about 5 years, not quite. But I'd worked there so long that I had enough time in, you know, to take just a regular retirement. I didn't do a buyout or anything like that. I just retired. It wasn't near as much fun at the end as it had been throughout a lot of my career, and I didn't feel like I was adding much at that point. Most of the momentum was and frankly had to be toward contraction, and that's never been my specialty.
No, so you got to kind of high grade. Yeah, and pretty damn lucky, really, when you think about it, in terms of the opportunities that came in front of this boy from Muldoon.
It was a confluence of great opportunities, really. It was even more remarkable than any one lucky thing happening. It had to be about five lucky things in a row, and I feel truly blessed by that. I mean, I've had an incredibly interesting career. I've had a career that allowed me to do things that most people don't get to do. I always used to tell young reporters when they were asking, should I get into this business or something, I'd say, yeah, look, I get paid to be curious. I get paid to stick my nose in where other people would get in trouble. I get to say what I think. And, you know, what's better than that? Not much.
Yeah. Write hard, die free. It, until you wrote how you derived this title, I did not realize that I actually live right down the street from this motto at the Hell's Angels Clubhouse in Spinard.
That's true. Ride hard, die free was their motto. And I actually have to admit I didn't ask permission to adapt their motto. But once we did it,
I have a feeling it's going to be okay.
Once we did it, it actually kind of caught on. And one of the things I thought was most fun was maybe a year or so after we first introduced. We introduced this as I gave it to the staff as a Christmas present one year, little pins that said, Ride Hard, Die Free. And it turned out that the governor's office was cutting the budget that year. Some things never change. And so they loved it so much, they had buttons made up for their staff that said, free rides, die hard.
Oh,
and so it's really got a life of its own now, and I'm pretty proud of that.
Okay, so as I said, return with us now to those thrilling days. It's very interesting the way the book ends. Well, I don't know, Bill Allen and all that stuff. And Bill Allen's going to show up as a character in your book quite a bit. He has to. But the way it begins is with you just plunging into this world of this definitely the number two newspaper in the city of Anchorage. And I'm thinking it was like 1971, right?
I first started, actually, I was in high school in 1967, but I came back from college in 72.
Yeah.
And went to work full time.
So really, you don't really quite have even the pipeline boom yet.
No, there was no pipeline boom, although it was being talked about and the fights were going on.
Right.
You know, the native claims had been filed and the right-of-way leasing was all up in the air and taxes and what have you. So we knew it was coming, but it really was just on the horizon for me. I was far more interested in what was going on 4th Avenue than I was what was going on the Hall Road.
Well, you know, I got here in 82. And we had, you know, there was plenty of pipeline boom going on yet, but actually the biggest part of it had already passed. And when I started reading your book, Write Hard, Die Free, Dispatches from the Battlefields and Barrooms of the Great Alaska Newspaper War, and he gets a Muldoon kid, walks into this newsroom, and there's all these crusty characters right out of Damon Runyon.
Yeah, it felt like that to me. And I have to admit that I brought a certain amount of kind of romantic intention to it, probably. But I didn't have anything in my background to suggest that. You know, there were no newspaper people in my family. My dad was a newspaper reader because he was a, you know, sort of student of history and politics. But I don't know what it was, but I was quite sure the minute I started it that it was what I was supposed to do. There was never a doubt about that from the first days there at the Daily News.
But these people are, to put it generously, they're a bit twisted.
Well, some of them were quite twisted.
And this radio station. This is not the number one newspaper. This is definitely the number two newspaper. And these people with like drinking problems and weird obsessions and Lord knows what else.
And a lot of passion and a certain amount of idealism. Both of those are odd things too. You know, it was interesting to me that the Daily News was actually founded, as I understand it, by the anti-statehood forces. And so the Daily News had more or less been on the losing end of most of these statewide debates ever since it was a weekly newspaper. And so it was definitely number two in terms of money and circulation and prestige and influence. So it was, but it had as a result this kind of quest feeling. You know, you Write Hard, Die Free, the title also to me bespeaks a kind of quest. You know, if you write hard, then you can die free. And we felt like at the Daily News, we had the opportunity to do that in ways that frankly, the Anchorage Times didn't. I mean, they were a very establishment newspaper. Not surprising. They were the establishment. But there were certain constraints, I think, on them that we didn't feel. And that opened up the field to us to do a lot of things. And we had some real fun doing it.
Yeah. In a way, it's a deceptive way to open the book because you can't keep up all that color all the way through. Plus, you're going to get pretty quick to people that are still alive that you want to be careful what you say about them.
Well, that's kind of true. And the other thing that happens, of course, is that somewhere through the book, I stopped drinking. So that probably took some of the color out of it right there.
Well, it did. And you write very honestly about that. My hat's off to you for that.
Well, it's a big part of my life and has been for a long time now. I suppose if I hadn't been able to quit, then it wouldn't have been a book. So,
but one of the things about sobriety, and particularly the you know, AA path, is that you don't have to talk about it.
Well, and I've tried to walk a line in my writing between what I did and any particular program or endorsement or anything else, because I'm not doing that. I mean, I needed to tell people drinking had been such a big part of my early career that it just wasn't honest to not mention that a big change came right in the middle, sort of 1985.
Right.
And of course, I needed to write about it.
That's a damn long time ago now.
It is a long time. I think about that sometimes. And, you know, as an adult, I guess I've now been sober longer than I was not sober. And so that's pretty interesting to me. Not, I suppose, that interesting in a lot of ways to other people, but it was a big factor, and I felt like I had to say something about it. When I started, you know, the one thing I told myself was, I'm going to try and write this thing, and the only way to do that is to promise myself I will be as honest as I can all the time. Because if you start cutting those corners and shading things, then it gets to be a less and less valuable for me as a writer and for the reader. That's not to say that I told every secret I know. It's not to say that I was entirely honest about myself or other people at all times. We all, you know, I think, view the world through a kind of personal filter. But I tried very hard to be as honest as I could be all the way through.
Well, it takes an awful lot to even fact check your own damn stories. I mean,
it does.
I mean, it's just really scary when you start and you go back, oh, actually, it wasn't like that at all. That's just the way I remember it.
And that happened to me explicitly a couple of times. There were things I remembered very clearly that I checked. I wanted to just be double sure. And somebody says, no, I don't, if I'd have heard that, I would have done something. You know? And I said, well, shoot, I was sure you told me that. And all I'm really sure is somebody told me that, you know. And
yeah,
it was also humbling, I would say, to look at some of my early journalism, and I think I say this in the book too, that and to realize, for example, how many anonymous sources. You know, I became kind of a critic of anonymous sources. The Daily News, most of my career, used far fewer anonymous sources than most mainstream newspapers. And we just thought it was, you know, basically always the second best choice if you could. But I see now that when I was a young reporter, I had no compunctions at all about sources close to the investigation or a normally well-informed person says.
You know, we may get back to this, we may not, but it's an interesting thing in our profession, and I include myself in the journalism profession, although I'm kind of in a different branch, but how quickly we get big ideas about ourselves and take on airs and start espousing principles we can't possibly live up to. Mm-hmm. We put ourselves on a pedestal over and over and over again. I don't know why. And then we get trapped into that straitjacket of pretending that we are
superhuman,
that we're meeting those standards that we can't possibly meet. And this happened over and over and over again. And in a sense, the interesting times are when all that falls apart and you get something else, like when you started The Advocate, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And you get so you're leaving the Daily News, which is which in really bad financial shape by this point, and starting a newspaper that's going to be an Advocate. And so you call it The Advocate and say, yeah, we're going to be on the left wing here, folks.
Yeah, well, we did.
And you had a ball. And you did some great stuff.
And I can't think of anything I would have done for 2.5 years where I could have learned more. You know, if I'd gone back to graduate school in journalism or if I'd, gotten an MBA or something like that, I would not have learned nearly as much as I did in those 2.5 years. Some of what I learned was ways to do things wrong. But I also learned what wonder you can find if you approach something wholeheartedly. If you go out there and, you know, we just had no business starting a business. And that proved to be demonstrable in the end. But I'm very proud of the fact that we started this little newspaper with $5,000 in capital. Four of us each had $1,250 we could scrape together. And so we put it together. We had $5,000. It cost about $3,000 a week just to operate, you know, to pay the printer, to pay the rent, to pay the phone bills and all that. So somehow we parlayed $5,000 into 2.5 years of. And I think that's an accomplishment in itself. It says something about the desire of Alaskans to read that kind of thing. And our desire, you know, we did it, most of us without pay. So here's a hat tip to the working wives and girlfriends who basically supported us.
Oh, yeah. It's almost like being an artist.
it felt like that. I mean, that's probably part of the pretense, too, though. You know, it's.
Yeah. Well, that's the deal. See, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm picturing young journalism students listening to this show right now, and what do you say about this career path? And, you know, what I say about radio as a career path is there's no money in it. So eliminate that right away, and then it can be a hell of a lot of fun. But this business, I mean, throwing really some of your bodily condition and like 2 years of hard times, and then you got to say for what? What was it really for? It was like for an idea, but can you tell me what?
Yeah,
speaking from the perspective of talking to some journalism student right now looking at this as a career path.
Well, I can say a couple of things about that, and I've thought a lot about it. I mean, my last job at McClatchy, I was the chief editorial officer for the company. There are 31 daily newspapers, and one big part of my job was sort of talent scouting. So I would go to journalism conventions and minority journalism associations and Howard University and try and recruit people. And so I answered that question a lot. And even then, there were some clear indications that the newspaper business was never going to be what it had used to be.
Right.
And that the whole ecosystem of journalism was changing. But people will say, well, you know, Mr. Weaver, would you do you think I should go into journalism and why? And I would say, I think you should, and for exactly the same reason I did, which was not to make a lot of money, which was not to make some newspaper owner a lot of money. It was to have a chance to have a career that made a difference. You know, I feel like my career gave me a chance to be involved in ideas and issues and fights that mattered. And I got to be part of it instead of, just working a kind of 9-to-5 and going home. And there's nothing wrong with that, of course. Most people do that and find plenty of ways to find fulfillment. I happen to find mine more or less in the arena. And so that gave me a chance to do it. And I've thought about this too, Steve, if I can. People would say, how can you advise a young person to go into journalism today, knowing what you do about the economics of the thing and the internet's killing newspapers?
Absolutely, yeah.
But you know what? In 1974, when John Greeley and I sat around the smoky bar room in Juneau and dreamed up The Advocate, that was at least that much of a long shot, right? It made no sense. I mean, the fact is that people with a passion for things will find a way to exercise that passion, and it won't always be the same. Tomorrow's journalism will not be the same. Certainly the delivery systems won't be the same. But I fully expect that it will evolve and mature into a valuable contribution, and that the young people sitting out there today, you know, who are 21, 2, 3 years old, are going to be the ones that figure that out. I got a chance to do it. I sat there, I played this incredible long shot, and it paid off into a 40-year career that you know, I got to do a lot of stuff. I made some money. I made an enormous number of friends, and I had fun.
We're speaking with Howard Weaver, former managing editor of the Anchorage Daily News. And if you're one of the people that was involved in these efforts that we'll be talking about, The Advocate is only the beginning of it, really. And I know a lot of them, and some of them are probably listening right now. John Greeley, for instance, feel free to call. Or even if you don't know about and have some questions or some ideas or want to join the conversation, that's what Talk of Alaska is for, and it's statewide. So we're talking you too, Barrow. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. One thing that happened when you started the Advocate was that we didn't really have our public radio system going yet.
No, it was...
So you were the statewide medium.
And that was what we thought was our business niche, if you will. We thought, gosh, there isn't anybody who's even trying to be statewide. And that was true. You know, Alaska's always been intensely regional. The Bush has never trusted Anchorage for some pretty good reasons, traditionally. Excuse me. And Anchorage has always been, had this burning desire to be the big dog, you know, to relocate the capital, to take over the headquarters for the Army, to whatever it was, Anchorage wanted it. And so it was always regional. And we thought, man, maybe we could be the one voice that tried to speak to everybody. And as embryonic as we were and as poor as we were, we had full-time reporter in Juneau, John Greeley. We had a full-time reporter in Fairbanks, Andy Williams. We had two or three of us in Anchorage. And just with that, we became instantly the most statewide news organization in Alaska. And it turned out to be a wonderful idea journalistically, maybe not so much on an economic basis.
And in a way, you know, the Alaska Public Radio System sort of inherited that mantle. I mean, I remember a conversation with Willie Hensley where he said, well, the reason we threw so much money into public broadcasting in Alaska is because the Bush needs to know what's going on in Juneau. Something would take weeks to find out. They need to find out that day.
Yes, and well, I tell you what, I take no credit for the establishment of the Alaska Public Broadcasting, but I will say that it's something I'm really proud to be associated with, because it's you move outside of Alaska and you realize that this doesn't exist everywhere.
Right.
There may be one or two places that are similar. Minnesota Public Radio comes to mind and so on, but you know as well as I do that you look back at NPR and they call it the Alaska Mafia. There are all these former Alaskans there, you know, Corey Flintoff and Peter Kenyon and just lots of people, Elizabeth Arnold. And so, yeah, it's something very special here. And Alaska is special. And that's something that I know the people who I did this with in Alaska will know it when they read the book. A lot of people read this book elsewhere won't have any idea what that's about.
Right. Well, let's listen. We got, you know, stuff's going on in the world. Andrew Breitbart just died. Pulitzers were just handed out. We got a lot of stuff we can talk about in the context of this story. And I think I'll go to the Pulitzers because the Anchorage Daily News got two of them. One of them in your fairly early days when you went after the Teamsters. And the paper couldn't afford to do this, and it did it anyways. Kay Fanning just basically decides to do it. And you guys got your ducks in a row. and went after Jess Carr. And I think you, I wasn't here in those days, but I think I've certainly heard plenty of tales.
You know, the thing I'm most proud about on that story is that it wasn't any gigantic revelations. It wasn't like we, you know, that lots of people went to jail or anything else. The thing that I'm proud of about it is that it was an extremely dimly lit corner, and we shined some light in it. And that's a fundamental thing journalism can do. You know, it's not all cops and robbers. It's not all good guys and bad guys. Sometimes it's just ignorance and information. And we had a chance, because nobody else was willing to look at the Teamsters. They were genuinely the most powerful institution in the state, politically and growing economic power and what have you. And so people were deferential. And so we were able to say what was actually there. How big was it? How powerful was it? How much influence had they influenced in the legislature? And so I would say it wasn't really a going after sort of experience. We weren't trying to catch somebody doing something. We were trying to explore, what the hell is this? You know, I mean, everybody talks about the Teamsters. People are scared to talk about them. You hear stories. Are the stories true? What are we going to know here? And it was really wonderful that there's couple of young guys could poke around long enough to find that out.
In a way, it was a frontier experience. The way that the Teamsters Union got to exercise so much leverage because they wanted that pipeline so bad,
right?
And they got cradle to grave,
yes,
coverage. I mean, in a way. This is if you like labor, Teamsters was doing everything right. They were finally getting the social contract to go somewhere.
If you were a working person,
Walter Reuther couldn't make that happen.
If you were a working person in Alaska and wanted to be covered by a union, you would have been crazy to choose any other union because the Teamsters were so successful. And you mentioned going in here, Steve, that I'd been really lucky. That was one of the things to early in my career have a chance to deal with an institution at that pinnacle of its power.
Right. And it was a piece of history. I mean, I think Pulitzer was right. If you guys did good work, it deserved to be recognized just to look at this unique piece of history that was going on here.
It really was. And I can remember the you mentioned cradle to grave, and that was literally true. I mean, there was prenatal health care and burial benefits, right? It covered the whole spectrum. And just as a sort of illustration of the color of this, the Times referred to it, the Anchorage Times was a little more conservative than us. They called it cradle-to-grave coverage. And at the Daily News, we called it womb-to-tomb because we were little. But the Teamsters themselves referred to it as erection-to-resurrection. They
well,
had you covered.
They would pay for funerals and stuff.
Oh, absolutely. They had the best health club in the state. They had their own hospital.
Totally, yes.
And it was and I've been criticized, in fact, fairly recently by somebody who read the book saying, you know, you guys never gave the Teamsters the credit for what they did. And I think to some degree that's true because, in general, journalists tend to look at problems more than they do solutions. I think there's some good reasons for that, but be that as it may, it's still true. We spent a lot of time talking about some of the abuses and some of the problems politically and otherwise that they had created. But the fact is, during that window of opportunity of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline construction, it was an extraordinary institution.
Amazing. And I think I see the calls from alumni are already coming in.
Uh-oh.
And our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. If you don't recognize the voice, it is Howard Weaver, former managing editor of the Anchorage Daily News. He's got a book out. It's a memoir about the times at the Daily News. He moved on to Sacramento and McClatchy headquarters and all that, and he also did some exploring. In the early days of newspapers going over to the web, we do say the early days of that now.
Right.
We'll get to that too, but before we start with the calls, Howard, let's talk a little bit about the other Pulitzer, which was for people in peril. This is a mature Anchorage Daily News is pulling this one off, and this is controversial. And just as you got attacked, really, for only seeing the bad side of the Teamsters, you were attacked for only seeing the bad side of rural Alaska, Alaska Natives, drinking problems, and youth suicide.
Well, we were attacked to some degree, but I think the more remarkable story is the degree to which we were not, to which rural Alaska embraced the story to a much larger degree than you would have predicted, because I was very aware going into this that we were in an urban, largely white newspaper writing about the problems of rural, largely brown people. And that is just loaded. And both suicide and alcoholism are issues that are surrounded by denial. Right? Nobody talks about their cousin's suicide. Nobody talks about their mom's alcoholism.
Well, we do it to this day. When somebody does something stupid and drunk and sets their cabin afire or dies in a car wreck and they're obviously were drunk, we don't have to say they're drunk. It's the alcohol was involved.
Yeah, and I understand that intimately. By the way, I understand how that family dynamic works. But the fact is, we became convinced that it was such a huge problem and that if people didn't talk about it, there was no hope to fix it. Now, obviously, it's extremely difficult to fix, and our stories did not fix it. I wish I could even say with any confidence that they started the fix, but I do know that they made it legitimate to talk about it. And I did something in that story that I've never done before as an editor, which was before the stories appeared in the paper, I went and visited people like Willie Hensley, Roy Hundorf, people that were in the village health corporates and so on, and told them what was coming, because I wanted them to know, first of all, why we were doing it, that it was not our intention to be sensational in any way, but that it was a horrible story and we needed to articulate it. And I was gratified that a very large number of those folks understood that. And I'm not saying that they were thrilled that we were going to write this, but after we wrote it, we reprinted it. And native rural health cooperatives bought thousands of copies of that to pass out to their own shareholders. And the Alaska National Guard, which, as you know, is a largely rural institution in Alaska, bought copies of it to use in their wellness programs and so on. So I felt that given the loaded situation, we were about as successful as we could have hoped to be. And I'm very proud of that series. That far more than the Teamsters or anything the Advocate did, really. I think that was the best journalism I've ever been involved in my career.
Well, when you have whatever there are, social, cultural, generational dynamics that are essentially in a downward spiral, and the dialogue is then displaced to where it can go someplace new. And I think we did get that, whether it was your series contribution or people just having enough, whatever you want to say it was, There has been movement. It's a different situation now than it was when the Daily News wrote about
and
it.
And we were
being ignored.
We were a part of that continuum. We were not the beginning of it nor the end of it, but by God, we got to be a part of it, and I'm proud of that.
Martha, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello, good morning. I've been listening while I've been on hold. I've been listening to the conversation on the radio, and I've been thinking about the past and. Welcome back to Alaska, Howard. I'm a former employee of the Daily News, and I was hired by Howard's right-hand guy at the time, Pat Doherty, who is now the editor. And when Howard left the Daily News, he was the editor, and I worked for him starting in 91 as a writer. And I was thinking back to I had a few things I wanted to first to comment. I was thinking back to when Howard won the first Pulitzer Prize. He won it along with two other people. One of them was Bob Parker, Bob Porterfield, and he was married to Marsha Parker Porterfield, who worked for the Associated Press out of New York. And I met Bob when I lived on the East Coast going to college, so I knew him socially, and he was working for a Long Island newspaper, I think it was Newsday, and he was quite the character.
Hmm. Bob was involved in two or three Pulitzers over the years. You know that.
Yes, I think he did go on to win a Pulitzer or two. And then the other person who Howard won the Pulitzer with was James Bennington Babb, who is a local attorney now. And I work for him as a volunteer reporter at the now-defunct Tundra Times. And he was editor there. And even then, this is post the Pulitzer, he said, set me to work traveling in rural Alaska to write about the energy crisis. So I think that had an impact in Juneau, which was, I think, one of Jim Babb's intentions. But that's just a commentary on the first Pulitzer. But I had a two-part question. One is, I haven't read the book yet, but I'm intrigued about hearing about it. And I'm just wondering about the time frame of the book, for one part of the question. And then being a journalist by trade, I have another part of the question. And the second part is, if Howard could reminisce about the later publishers he worked with. I remember when the Anchorage Times was taken over by a guy with a weapon, and he got into Mr. Atwood's office. And I think it was after that time when Fuller Cowell was a publisher, and I remember in the New Daily News building, which is where they are now, Fuller Cowell was a publisher. When I was first, it was it Mr. Greeley?
Jerry Greeley, yeah.
Yeah, Jerry Greeley, and he was quite the colorful person. And then, so I worked for the at the tail end of Jerry Greeley's administration, and then Fuller Cowell, and then Mike was at the tail end of my 10-year career there. But I don't know if you mentioned in the book, Howard, about what happened with Bob Atwood. And then I think one of the effects at the Daily News when Fuller Cowell came on board was he had a back door put into his boardroom, which which happened to have to go out through Howard's office. So basically, instead of Howard coming and going through the newsroom where everyone would see him, on occasion, if he wanted to, he could slip out the back door through his through the boardroom because it connected to Fuller's office.
Well, you know, everybody needs an escape hatch at some point, Martha. It's really nice to hear from you. It's Martha and I worked together in some really interesting times. And frankly, she brought a perspective to the Daily News that it was rarely had. You know, there were no Inupiaq staffers, basically, when she started working there, and very few over the years. And that's one of the issues that's always worth talking about. The time frame, Martha, is pretty straightforward. I kept it narrowed down to the time that I was there. Obviously, there was a bit of a newspaper war before I got there, and obviously there have been a lot of developments at the newspaper since I left. But I thought the best thing for this book, at least, and for me to do, was to try and talk about the things I could talk about personally, where I could add something to the discussion because I was there. And not all of those things will be balanced. I mean, I had a particular point of view on them, and other people will have different points of view. But anyway, that's the way I framed the time frame. And
yeah, Martha, yes, he does write about Fuller Cowell.
I do write about some of the publishers. It's an inevitable thing, you know, as well as any journalist, that newsrooms and publishers or business sides, whatever they are, sometimes have different incentives. And different, you know, the newsroom wants to stir up trouble, and the front office often wants to keep things quiet. So there's a tension there, and it's always been there, as far as I know, in American journalism, and it's certainly there today.
Martha, I've got to take a break, so I'm going to return to this on the other side. Is that okay, Martha?
Okay, thank you. I just had one. I just wanted to comment real quickly about People in Peril. I was quoted in it, but I also appreciate the fact that the Daily News was able to help define the problem. And I was off the record. I was one of the contributors to that. Was one of the key reporters there before my time at the newspaper, and I appreciate the fact that it helped. Define some of the problems, which even in things like statistics keeping, were not being accurately kept. So even things like death certificates and how a person died, even that took a reporting effort. So I appreciate what went on, and it is an ongoing problem. But I appreciate what you did at the time. Thank you. I'll let you go there, guys.
All right, Martha. Yeah, thanks a lot. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life.
Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
It's Talk of Alaska, one of my favorite themes, History on the Run. History on the Run, the first draft of history will happen in the newspapers, happens in the media. You're watching history go by, and as best you can, you're trying to tell people what's going on. Howard Weaver's my guest, author of Right Heart, Die Free. Is it actually in print yet? I've got a galley, but...
It is in print now, finally, and people are starting to get copies. There will be copies in the bookstores in Anchorage. You know, we're at the museum later tonight, and I know that they've got copies that they're ready to sell. And as is the case in the modern world, it's also available from Amazon.com, and it's also available as an electronic book, an e-book on Nook or Kindle or what have you.
If you were around for any of this, you probably do want to read this. It'll bring back a lot of memories. It certainly did for me, and I was around for just part of the time that he writes about. David chimes in and says, glad to hear your voice and perspective this morning. Appreciated the sober now longer than not sober statements. he said, there are good and not so good Alaska Native reporters. What suggestions do you have for a good infrastructure for retention of good Alaska Native reporters? He probably put some thought into that one.
Oh, it's a very good question and one that we never answered successfully. So I don't pretend to have the answer or maybe even an answer, but I do know, as the question suggests, how important it is because newspapers or any mass medium, let's not talk about newspapers, let's talk about, it could be a website, it could be the Alaska Dispatch, it could be any number of things. But if you want to represent the views and talk about the issues of a whole community, the only way to do that in the end is to reflect that diversity yourself. And we worked hard to do that over the years, but with mixed success. Part of it, I always thought, in Alaska at least, was that the kind of person who might be attracted to journalism, you know, articulate, able to write, able to talk and argue, and so on, often if that was an Alaska Native person, they also had tremendous opportunities to work for their own village corporation or regional corporation, and that was a pretty seductive thing because you could work with your own folks, you know, and in a direct way, have a chance to influence things. So we felt like we were competing in that sense for a certain talent pool. The question suggested, you know, retention. I think also a big part of that would need to be how do you grow your own? We tried over the years providing scholarships that were specifically aimed at rural Alaskans, and that means disproportionately, obviously, Native Alaskans. And some very smart and capable people moved through the office at that point. Sometimes they'd stay a year or two, sometimes they wouldn't. And we had staffers like John Tetpon and Martha Upikson and others who made huge contributions over a period of years while they were there. But it's not something that, to my knowledge, has ever been successfully answered by any Alaska media.
Yeah, and David, as you know, I put a lot of thought into that one. And I tend to think that the form has to change. I mean, if there are the people brought up traditional, speaking a different language, asking them to like go into somebody else's storytelling form with somebody else's language, not so good. You know, they were the better storyteller to start with. So there are ways of telling stories. What we haven't done is match up the way of telling the story with the medium. But with all this internet stuff that's going on and all the changes of forms, it's just like blossoming right now. I think I would advise a little dose of hip hop maybe.
You know, that I remember a moment that really captured my attention. It was when the Prairie Home Companion was broadcasting from Alaska.
Yeah.
One of, I guess, two or three times they did that.
And Chuna stole the
Chuna
show.
Chuna McIntyre was the local performing guest. And he did a great job, as you would expect him to do. And then at one point, I remember he was talking with Garrison Keillor. And this is the way I remember it. I hope this is accurate. Garrison Keillor basically saying, you know, there are you know, different cultures in Alaska, and the cultures can learn from one another, we hope. Don't you think so, Chuna? And Chuna says, I think the native cultures have things to teach the Western culture. And Garrison Keillor says, well, like what? And then there's a 2 or 3 second pause, and Chuna said, quietness.
Ha, ha.
You know, and it was just a beautiful moment. I was actually at our cabin in Ketchumak Bay listening on the transistor radio to that, and I can remember literally tearing up because I knew what he was talking about, and I knew a lot of Alaskans knew what he was talking about. I'm not sure how many people listening to Prairie Home Companion got it, but I got it.
Did you see the movie Big Miracle?
I didn't. No, I should have.
Well, John Pingaiak steals that, so still going on.
All right, I'll watch for that.
Got a call from Juneau. John Greeley has called in. I asked. John, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve. Hi, Howard.
Hey, John. I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
Yeah, you could come to town and guess what they're talking about in the legislature? Oil tax.
Oh, my God. I don't think...
Nothing changes after 40 years, I think.
I know. That's a lesson we can spend a little time kicking around.
Yeah. Well, I've read your book. I just called in to congratulate you and recommend people buy it. It's a great read. I thought you did a concise and honest encapsulation of that 20 years of history in Alaska journalism and Alaska. The interesting part about it is the journalism, but it's also the history of what the state was going through at the time. And so, for a lot of people, I think it will resonate with them as Alaskans. So congratulations. And I think maybe you've got another book in you. When I got a chance to read it on Kindle, and the end of the book, you kind of seemed to promise another one coming out sometime.
Well, I promised that I was interested in it. And, it's a really good topic, and I'll just outline it really quickly here because I want somebody to think about this, and it may not be me in the end who can do it, but I was born in Alaska because I had these idealistic parents who, right after World War II, they were farm kids in Texas. They bought a pickup truck and drove to the end of the road, which was Anchorage, and stayed here because they were idealists. They wanted to create a new kind of place. They wanted to be part of something, and in those days, right, the statehood movement and writing a constitution and becoming a full-fledged state, all those things were right on the surface of everybody's attention, it seemed to me. And Alaska was a very idealistic place. Somehow, in my lifetime, Alaska went from that to Sarah Palin. And describe that how you want. Maybe people will see that as progress. I don't, but it's a huge change. Somewhere along the way, it seems to me that sense of idealism and optimism lost its way. And I don't know if it's possible to find out why that's true or what happened exactly, but I think it would be really interesting to spend some time talking to people who have been around the state for a while, people who have thought about these questions, and see if you can tease any answers out of it. So that's something I've thought about doing.
Well, if you need a couch to sleep on, you always got my place. So
it wouldn't be the first time. Thank you, John.
Steve, thanks for inviting Howard on. I think he's got a busy week ahead of him this week with his book, and I would recommend it to Alaskans.
John, thanks a lot for calling. I really appreciate it. It adds a lot to the show, and I really feel privileged to get the first shot here.
I tell you, and a lot of people know this, but the last few years maybe it hasn't been as clear. John Greeley really is one of the great statewide reporters that Alaska has ever seen. He spent a lot of time in the legislature, which is a statewide institution, but also has just really put in the miles and the years to pay attention to it.
Yeah, John, thanks a lot again.
You bet, and good luck.
Thank you. Howard Weaver, the guest, Write Hard, Die Free, Dispatches from the Battlefields and Barrooms of the Great Alaska Newspaper War. I want to pick up Martha's theme a little bit here because we haven't even talked about the newspaper war. But essentially, you just, when you were talking about, well, what's happened to Alaska, you sort of touched on this business of your parents' generation and statehood and the battle for statehood and all that. Then you get the earthquake, you get the pipeline boom, you get the weird financial shakeout that happened in 1986, when all the banks went under and all
right.
that sort of thing, all the condos that were built, that people just abandoned. Kind of interesting little bust that we had back then. And the newspaper that Bob Atwood had The Anchorage Times, the dominant newspaper that you guys vanquished, really was a part of that era.
Oh, it was definitional to that era, in my opinion.
Yeah.
There were rarely, was there an American newspaper that had more influence within its footprint than the Anchorage Times. And this is something I should say now, and I'll try and remember to say it a couple times this week talking, is that I wrote this book from my perspective, and I was from the Daily News. There's not a great deal of representation in the book from what it felt like from the other end of Fourth Avenue, you know, where the Times was located. And obviously, I understand that there is a different position. But to me, I saw the Anchorage Times more often than not as being an obstruction. And to talk about Alaska Native Affairs just for a minute, I mean, it was widely considered racist. It was considered to be so centered on the kind of Anchorage Chamber of Commerce view of the world that everything else was kind of an intrusion. And I quote in the book several times visiting congressmen who would make that point and how the Times was crusading against the Alaska Native land claims by more or less suggesting they were being led down the garden path by these Jewish lawyers from the East Coast. And, you know, that's not a pretty picture. But as I remember their posture over the years, it was rarely supportive of Alaska Native sovereignty or self-determination or really anything.
Yeah.
And there's a quote in there, I don't know if he still feels this way, but Roy Hundorf was quoted by a couple of guys who came up and wrote a book about Alaska called Lost Frontier as saying that everything kind of changed when the Native land claims happened and the corporations began to get wealthy, some of them. And he said it was really hard for the Times to balance their economic greed versus their racism. And, you know, that's an ugly thing to say, and I'm conscious of the fact that I'm saying it with Mr. Atwood already gone and the Anchorage Times gone, although there are still lots of people who worked there and knew that operation, and they obviously will have opinions much wider than mine, but it was a big deal. And the fact was the Daily News, traditionally, even as the number two paper, paid way more attention to rural Alaska, starting before I was working there with a series called The Village People that later was redone as the Emerging Village People, and then I had a chance to work on two subsequent things. One, The Village People Revisited, and then finally People in Peril. All of a part of trying.
Yeah, don't forget Tom Keziah's work out there.
Oh, and Tom.
Very, very good stuff.
Tom's book, The Wake of the Unseen Object, is really informed by the rural perspective. And I don't know if you know, but he's working on another one right now that's due to come out next year. So
I really look forward to it.
Oh, boy, me too.
Another talk show guest. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
It's Howard Weaver. We're talking newspaper history here on Talk of Alaska, and Ken joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ken.
Thank you. I heard Howard's remark about the Times having a Chamber of Commerce view in those old days, and I remember that. It annoyed me so much that I composed a fake letter pretending to be an employee of the Scandinavian Airlines, and I used sort of quaint language like I was a Scandinavian person.
And you used a fake name, as I recall.
Anal Sphincter. And I spelled it differently, and I called up SAS and found out their mailing address and put that on the letter and signed his name as a purser. And the paper printed it, and the Alaska Advocate gave the editor the White Cane Award that year for letting that letter in.
Oh, newspaper editors live in fear of people like you, Ken.
I know that, but they drove me to it with that Chamber of Commerce. You couldn't say a bad thing about Anchorage, you know, but they'd print every syrupy confection about it. It reminded me of what O'Hara said about a Hollywood or a Los Angeles newspaper in the old days. The headline read, L.A. Dog Chases L.A. Cat Over L.A. Fence. The height of provincialism. But I have very many fond memories of the Alaska Advocate. I look forward to it coming out every week. Somewhat like your parents, I came up here in 1948. How idealistic I was, I don't know. But
well, we know you were pretty inventive, if nothing else, Ken.
Yeah, and thank you for all you've done.
Thanks for your call.
Ken, what a great call. Thank you. I love people telling tales. Let's go to Gene, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Gene, you're on the air with Howard Weaver.
Thank you, Steve. Howard, welcome back to Anchorage.
Another voice I recognize.
You recognize my voice, Howard?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, we worked together in the early days at the Daily News, and I do have the perspective of having spent some time at the Anchorage Times before that. The only job I've ever been fired from in my life, and I found out that there was a revolving door at the Anchorage Times that few people had gone through. The difference between the Anchorage Times and the Daily News at that point was pretty drastic. As you recall, Howard, we put in a lot of hours in that old warehouse down there on Post Road, getting the newspaper out and the old Linotype machines in the back room, and had Kay Fanning ask us to go out and sell newspapers on the corner after putting in, 50 or 60 hours a week to put the paper together, we would have done it.
That's true.
Camaraderie there that didn't exist at the other establishment. One of the questions I have is the remark you made earlier about shining light into dark corners was one of the things that you did during the Teamsters series, and it sort of frustrates me today that there's not more light being shined into dark corners or the ability to find where that is happening, because so much of it is happening online and through blogs. What is your assessment of the state of investigative reporting in this country today?
Well, it's a really good question, and one obviously we don't have enough time to talk about in full. Maybe we can, catch up at one of my other events and talk about that. But it's definitely true that it's changed. And the thing that has changed is there's not a dominant voice anywhere. I was, as an editor of the Anchorage Daily News, I occupied a role that newspaper editors traditionally did. I was a gatekeeper. I got to decide what went in the paper and what didn't, ultimately. And I worked very hard to do a good job at that, and either I did or I didn't. But anyway, that was my job, and I tried hard to do it. There is no gatekeeper today. People can, put information online. They can change the news agenda in any number of ways, often with really good results. But the fact is it's scattered. You may have heard talk about the filter bubble. The filter bubble being that if I go on the internet and only look at the things that I know I'm going to agree with, and you go on the internet and look at the things you're going to agree with, and then we get in an argument, we don't have any common basis for arguing.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk a little bit Wednesday at the Alaska Community Foundation about something I've worked on in journalism conventions recently, which is whatever happened to facts. How come we don't have agreed-upon consensus facts? And we just don't, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but it's a really good question, and it's going to get sorted out one way or another in, I think, the pretty near future.
Howard, I'd like to catch up with you while you're in town and maybe even have you autograph a copy of the book for me. Look forward to seeing you before you leave town.
Thank you, Gene. I look forward to it.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. It's Talk of Alaska. Howard Weaver is the guest, and man, I don't even know where to go. Let's go to Jim in Wasilla here. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Yes, I have a question. I remember when the Times and the Daily News had court order where the Times had to print the Daily News on their presses, and do you think the Daily News would have survived without that court order?
Well, it was an agreement, not a court order. The two parties made an agreement, and the court endorsed it. It was basically an exemption from antitrust rules. And I was 24 years old when they signed that agreement, and so I'm not sure my opinion's worth much.
But it was a straitjacket.
It was. It became a big problem for the Daily News, and then they sued the Times and got out of it. But your question is, would they have survived without it? And I think the honest answer is probably not.
Wow.
So, it
so
was
when you
one.
Say you vanquished the Times at sort of like the I think it was a Colorado case that was based on.
Yeah.
Well, it's and vanquished isn't a word I would use, but we did win the war, and so I guess you have to look at the final result more than the seventh inning.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, that's a question been on my mind since that went through. So
yeah,
thanks for answering that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Jim and Wasilla. Howard, one thing I really enjoyed about this is that I knew a couple things about you from back in the day. One, that you were a shortwave radio listener, mm-hmm. and another, that you really enjoy military history. And that is reflected in here. When you say Great Alaska Newspaper War, yes.
Well, we saw it that way.
Going all the way back to Lao Tzu.
We saw it that way, and I did. As Steve is suggesting, I was fond of quoting military aphorisms, and Lao Tzu, the Art of War, is one of the classics written, I don't know, well before the birth of Christ, seemed to have a lot of lessons that were applicable to us.
And when you have an adversary who's very well fed and well supplied and doesn't want to move.
Yes.
And you want to be the one that moves.
And he said, you know, there are certain villages that, if attacked, cannot be held, should never be attacked. And you have to, yeah, there's a lot to talk about there. We'll do another hour maybe on that someday.
All right, going to give the last word to Richard calling from Fairbanks. Talk about a journalist. Richard, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thank you very much. Howard, very good to talk to you, and the last caller just got it, and your question, whatever happened to the state, I wound up consulting for Sarah Palin, by the way. Part of the
did she listen to
is
you?
What I wanted to thank you for, which is a burning passion for the truth that I don't think we ever talked about, but I watched you come on as you were a sports editor when I did my first freelance, but when I really hit my stride, you were the editor and the beacon, and I owe a lot to you and want to thank you for that. And it was a burning passion for the truth that I see that we had. There are a couple of anecdotes I want to recall for you. One is
you're not going to have time, Richard. You got 20 seconds.
Basically, we went to the Club Paris for lunch before you closed on the series. And you didn't know what you were going to do. And you said, I'm losing sleep, and it's a generally good sign when I can't sleep at night, it is time to go. The other anecdote is Bob Porterfield had a lot of the documents in his trunk so that they couldn't get taken in the trunk of his car, so they couldn't be located and couldn't be taken from him.
He had a wonderful paranoia that sometimes served us very well.
Thanks, Richard.
Richard, let's try and talk in Fairbanks. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you so much for your call, Richard. And thank you, Howard, for being with us.
My pleasure.
The Alaska Spirit of Reading, coming up next on Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes in investing in early childhood development. It can produce great dividends for kids and our state. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.